Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding themselves, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with Lonnie Teeper and Peter McGough, where we are talking about the shape of bodybuilding in the future. And we had part one of our interview with Lonnie and Peter last week. And basically what we're doing is we're wondering if bodybuilding is going to go back to judging more of the symmetry and shape of the competitors as opposed to just muscle mass and conditioning, as it seems to have been the case over the last 30 years. And the reason I'm bringing up this question is because, number one, Arnold Schwarzenegger about 5 or 6 years ago made a statement at his Arnold Classic seminar. And he was complaining about how the bodybuilders today have the gut sticking out, they don't know how to pose, and this got a really big reaction from the general public. It was shared all over social media, and it seems like it's sort of happening now where the shape of bodybuilding is changing. So I wanted to bring Peter and Lonnie, who are both veteran investigative journalists in the bodybuilding field. Lonnie used to work for Iron Man magazine. Peter used to be the editor-in-chief of Flex magazine. They've both been around for decades. And I just wanted to bring them on and get their opinions on the way bodybuilding used to be judged and the way it is judged now. All right, before we get to that interview, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe contest in 2012. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia himself, Samir Banute, bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, and the real deal, Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order at oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, and later in the show, we are also going to be reading another article. I've done this several times now, starting this year. And this one is really a classic. It's from Sports Illustrated from the October 14th, 1974 issue. It was, I think, the first article ever written about bodybuilding in a mainstream magazine. And back then, you have to remember, Sports Illustrated was a huge magazine. Everybody read it every week. It was the magazine to go to for sports. So they had a really big article, and it was basically about bodybuilding with they interviewed Arnold Schwarzenegger. And this was about a week or two before the 1974 Mr. Olympia, when bodybuilding was really getting a lot of mainstream press. Pumping Iron, the book, had just come out. And I think the Mr. International contest that Franco and Arnold promoted had just taken place. And this writer had went to that contest and writes about that also in the article. So it's kind of a long article, so stay tuned after our interview with Lonnie and Peter, and you'll be able to hear me read the whole article if you've never read it. It's really, really a good article. I think you guys are really going to love it. All right, what else is going on? First of all, I want to welcome Mark Johnson, who is now one of our Patreon sponsors. Mark is donating $20 a month, so he is at our Mr. World tier, and as becoming a Mr. World tier Patreon, Mark is going to receive a copy of my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1, and he will also get 10% discount on any products that he orders through the shop page on the BodybuildingLegendsShow.com website. So thank you very much for Mark for being a Patreon supporter. It helps to keep this show going and keep the podcast going. I also want to thank Scott Barron and James Kerr because they are also Patreon supporters. So thank you guys very much. If any of you guys want to contribute to the show, if you like listening to the show and you want to help out with the cost, you can just go to my website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, there's a link there. It says Patreon, and you can become a donator to the show. All right, and what else is going on? Spring is here. Today is April 1st. We're recording the show a little bit late because we had some recording problems, so hopefully this intro comes out pretty good. I got to get a new router. Technical issues that always happen when you're recording these podcasts. So hopefully this will come out okay. But I am starting my new week, my new power week. As you guys know, I follow that MP6 workout, which I created myself, and I wrote a book about it called The MP6 Workout that's available on my website. It's also available on Amazon.com. And I split my training up into power cycles and mass cycles. So last week was my deload week, where I just go to the gym and I use only 50% of the weights I normally use. And this week I am starting my new power cycle, so I'm starting a whole new group of exercises, whole new workouts. I usually switch them up every time I start a new power cycle, and so I'm excited, ready to go back to the gym. April 1st, new month. I gained a little weight last month with my birthday celebration and that trip I took to Colorado, just kind of threw everything off. I heard that we are, if you're into horoscopes, there was like a Mercury retrograde that started, I think, on March 1st, at least for my sign. I don't know how that works. I don't know if it's for everybody or whatever, but I could definitely attest to that because I felt like I was off all month. But I'm feeling better now, mentally and physically, so I'm ready to rock and hit this new cycle starting today. What else is going on? I saw the new Captain Marvel movie finally the other day. That was pretty good. Not a great movie, but I guess it sets it up for the Avengers movie, which is coming out, I think it's this month, right, in April. And, of course, we also have the Game of Thrones is the last season. I think that's starting in two more weeks on April 14th, I believe, which is a Sunday. So everybody's excited about that. I read all those books of Game of Thrones, so now they're just sort of, I think, writing their own scripts because the show has gone beyond what George R.R. Martin has written in the books. So now they're kind of creating it on their own, the showwriters, so should be interesting to see what they do with it. I'm sure everybody's going to check that out. The Game of Thrones is probably one of the most viewed series ever. It's got a huge legion of fans. And speaking of fantasy stuff, I did see a video, an interesting video on YouTube this week regarding King Conan. And I guess Arnold is really trying to lobby himself into the role of King Conan. Arnold, of course, is now about 72 years old. And King Conan, if you're familiar with the books, King Conan is when Conan is the king of Aquilonia, which is the biggest city in the Hyperborean age where Conan lives. And Conan has now risen to the role of king, and he's sort of lackadaisical. He's not really doing anything. He's just kind of sitting on the throne, getting old, and something happens that brings him back into action, and he has to go defend the kingdom. So Arnold really wants to do this role, and I guess some younger guy, Arnold kept referring to him in the video as a young guy, he owns the rights from Robert E. Howard, who was the author of Conan, of the Conan books, who has since passed away a long time ago. So this guy, who I think is Swedish, I think he owns the rights to all the Conan books, and he's really not sure what to do with the rights. He tried to sell it to Netflix as a series, which would really be cool when you think about it, with what they could do now with CGI. And I think Netflix had a change in CEOs or people who are deciding what's going to be on, and this lady came in, and she turned it down. It was ready to go, and then she turned it down, so I'm not sure what they're going to do with it. Arnold is trying to get a script going where they can make a movie, and he could be King Conan, but it seemed like what they were doing with this Netflix series was they were going to use a younger Conan and have all the adventures of Conan, which I would be really psyched up to see because I was a big fan of the books when I was younger, when they had those Frank Frazetta covers on the cover of all the of the novels. So we'll see what happens with that, and hopefully Arnold can get back into the movies, but it doesn't look like it right now. It sort of looked like it's caught in production hell, so to speak. All right, last week's show, which was part one with Lonnie Teeper and Peter McGuff, I did not get any emails from you guys. I did get a lot of comments on my Facebook page because I posted the link to the podcast, and I'm not sure if these comments were from people who actually listened to the episode or just people who were fans of Lonnie and Peter, and they just sort of gave them a thumbs up and responded. So I'm going to read those comments to you. I got like 40 comments on the post I put on Facebook. So my friend Pete Fancher said he can't wait for this, or he can't wait to hear this one. Mark Sturck said, I love your podcast, John. I look forward to listening to this one. Michael Cox said, legends. George White said, top drawer, excellent. John Defendis, who was a champion bodybuilder, Mr. USA, and he was on our show before, he said, Lonnie Tepper and Peter McGuff are both awesome. Pete Pingle, who is a big listener to the show, said, this is going to be epic. Great one, John. Lee Haney himself, 8-time Mr. Olympia, said, this is going to be an interview for the records. So that was great to hear from Lee. Tom Terwilliger, another champion bodybuilder who was recently on our show, said, they may not be Mr. Olympias, but Lonnie Tepper and Peter McGuff are both legends in the sport nonetheless. Brett Davis said, two legends. George Betancourt said, bring it back to the basics. Andrula Blanchette, a champion female bodybuilder, said, awesome, I'm looking forward to this. John Torelli, another champion bodybuilder from Australia, said, with two experts like this, it'll be very informative. Russell B. said, this is going to be good. Keep up the great journalism, John. Dan Dillon, the mayor of bodybuilding, said, two of the best. Sean Ray did listen to the show, and he said, nice listen, John. Peter was right. I should have won in 1994. And he posted a great picture of him and Dorian from 1994 hitting a most muscular. And he said, 1994 was a great battle in spite of the final score. Mark Bates said, how on earth do Lonnie Tepper and Peter McGuff remember these past shows in such detail? What an incredible interview with two people I am lucky to call friends. I seriously think this is one of the best, if not the best, interviews I've ever heard. Lee Haney, how right you are, sir. Two bodybuilding icons right there. Mike Quinn said, I've done great interviews with both. My first story in Ironman after I turned pro was probably the best interview I've ever done. And Lonnie responded to that, and he said, Mike Quinn, thank you so much for the compliment on the interview I did with you after the 1986 Nationals, where Mike took fourth in the heavyweight class. He said, we did several more that received a lot of compliments due to your no-holds-barred responses. Gary Bartlett said, two of the best journalists in the game, and I consider myself very fortunate to know both these guys. Good stuff, John, keeping the golden days of our sport alive. Shaddy Shatster said, two great journalists, spitting bodybuilding knowledge, great interview. And Byron, who is Peter McGuff's wife, said, two true gentlemen. And Moisey Richardson said, Lonnie and Peter are vets in the bodybuilding game. So thank you guys for all those comments. I hope you really liked the episode. I also want to read some reviews I got on the Apple podcast. You know, of course, we are broadcasting on Apple Podcast, the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And you can do a ratings and review. So if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please take the time to rate the show. Right now we are rating at 4.5 out of 5, which is good. We've got 43 ratings, and we did get some comments, so I wanted to read those comments. A couple of them were pretty recent. This one was from Cross Is an Offense. And he says, as a 63-year-old fitness enthusiast and gym rat, I rapidly became addicted to this excellent podcast. The entertainment and historical value is unmatched by any other podcast of this kind. John is an excellent interviewer. Most fitness podcasters talk more than their guests, which irritates the crap out of me. John lets his guests tell their story, masterfully steering the interview in a way that maintains a steady flow, keeps your interest piqued. John is also a top-notch bodybuilder and fitness coach who has published some stellar work. Keep it coming, John. I'm loving it. All right, thank you for that great review. This review was kind of a criticism, but he makes some good points. He says, in a normal conversation mode, you continually give visual and auditory feedback while listening to someone speak. Unfortunately, it makes annoying to listen to. I'm sure it's almost unnatural to sit quietly while someone answers a question, but the best podcasts I listen to seem to have that consistent feature. The constant okays, ah, wows, and most oftentimes louder than the interviewees, and it gets in the way of the content. Besides that, it's a great show. I really enjoy listening to the history of the sport and the old school guys tell their stories. And this one was about our Porter Cottrell interview, which was last fall. He says, John, I was at the Continental USA contest that Porter won. If I remember right, I think it was an extremely close contest because it was the first time I saw Mike Mungovan. I think Jill O'Connor was the guest poser with an incredible performance. Another great interview. Wow, that brings some names up from the past. Mike Mungovan, for those of you who don't know, was a great bodybuilder who lived in the Chicago area. It kind of reminded me of Danny Padilla because he was kind of short, not as short as Danny, but he just had a perfectly developed physique, real great structure. Every muscle group was in proportion to one another, and he just had to come in really ripped, and he had the body. He had, like, the perfect body. I competed with him in the 1985 NPC Illinois State where Mike was in the light heavyweight class. I was in the heavyweights. He had a real close battle with a guy named Al Kirsch, and Mike unfortunately took second because he wasn't as hard as Al, and although I thought he had a better body. And he took the loss very hard. I don't know if he competed after that, but he did compete with Glenn Kinnear because Glenn, when we did our interview with Glenn a couple of weeks ago, he talked about how Mike won the overall the Junior USA contest, the AAU. And I think Glenn was in that contest or he took second. So that's a great name from the past. I wonder whatever happened to Mike because I think he could have went all the way. He could have been an IFBB pro. He really was that good. And Jill O'Connor was a girl who trained at our gym who took to bodybuilding like a fish takes to water. She grew so fast, but this is when women's bodybuilding was really about the symmetry and the beauty of the physique, and she wasn't overly muscular, but she had a great physique, and she went all the way and won the AAU Miss America contest in 1984, the year that Joe Miko won the Mr. America contest. So, I knew Jill really good. She used to train at our gym, and she was a real character, and unfortunately she passed away a few years ago, but those are some great names from the past, but if you guys, like I said, if you want to leave a review, I would really appreciate it. Just go to the Apple Podcast and click on the show, Bodybuilding Legends Podcast, and you can rate the show, and you can also leave a review. And speaking of podcasts, I heard Frank Zane himself is going to start his own podcast. I just read that on Facebook the other day, so good luck to Frank. I'm still trying to get Frank on our show, and I would love to interview him, so I'm going to keep trying. And I'll let you guys know what happens with that. Maybe he'll come on to promote his own podcast. That would be great. All right, and before we get to our interview, part two of our interview with Lonnie Teeper and Peter McGuff, I wanted to also mention that we are brought to you by our other sponsor, which is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services where you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So you can call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, which is 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their brand new website, which is flalternativemeds.com, flalternativemeds.com. You do not have to be in the Florida area for them to work with you because they'll work with you by phone or by Skype. So if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation, and they'll also give you 20% off your order. And they also have a new product called the Magic Pill that is developed and backed by science. This is a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. A one-month supply of this amazing fat-loss pill in Thermogenic is available for $39.99, so you can also call them at that number, 813-922-8939, and you can order yours and mention that you heard this ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I'm sure they'll give you a deal. All right, so that is it for our opening. Here is a part two of our interview with Lonnie Teeper and Peter McGuff, where we talk about where the shape of bodybuilding is going. Here you go.
Another great bodybuilder to me that was overlooked, and this is, do we put a little too much emphasis on actual conditioning? This guy didn't have bad condition, but he wasn't nearly as hard as some of his competitors, was Aaron Baker. I thought guy had a terrific, terrific physique.
Yeah. When he came back from W, I think he got 10th in the Olympic qualifier. But he had that. Maybe he'd do well today because he was a complete freak, you know, wasn't he?
Yeah, he had a beautiful shape.
Yeah, Athletics with freakiness, you know, somehow.
Now, I just wrote a piece for bodybuilding.com where can Brandon Curry win the Olympia?
Okay.
And, you know, that's a far jump. I mean, I really like Brandon's physique, but the Olympia lineup's a little different than the Arnold lineup. Mm-hmm. Now, he was fifth last year, so he's coming up. He's coming up. You know, Peter and John, do you think he could win the Olympia?
No, I don't think he's reached that stage. I think if he can repeat last year, that will be good for him. You know, he might get higher, but I don't see it. But then, to be honest, I mean, we all like Brandon. He's a great guy, but I think we mostly wrote him off, didn't we, 3 or 4 years ago? He came in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a comeback, a great comeback.
Yeah.
Dan Solomon said he didn't have a comeback. He was never way off. And then I started looking at all the placings and said, yeah, he was. And
he came eighth in his first Olympia. I can't remember the year, but then he just dropped off altogether.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he won the USA, I think, 10 or 12 years ago. I mean, he's been around a long time.
Yeah.
With the great shape. His legs have come up. I don't know if they come up enough to challenge for that title. But the question is Phil Heath coming back? And if Phil Heath comes back and his midsection is at least somewhat improved, is anybody going to beat him? Or does he win number 9?
That would be
eight. Yeah.
It would be number 8? Okay, that would tie him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was like John. I predicted that Phil Heath would never lose, that he'd win 10 straight Olympias and then retire. So another wrong prediction by me.
No, I I had the same opinion, Tony. Definitely.
Yeah, and I thought last year's show was closer than some people thought. Again, you know, to go back to it, and Peter mentioned this too.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, especially from the back. I mean, Heath really still dominated tremendously. And Sean was a little better from the front, and a beautiful, pleasing physique. But boy, there's a lot of muscle on Phil Heath. And there was a big debate after that. There's the shape versus the muscle deal again.
Yeah.
But I think in Phil's case, it was just that one body part was so egregious, and people have been talking about it for 4 or 5 years in a row now.
Right.
It stood out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, I want to ask you guys, a couple of years ago, Arnold at the Arnold Classic, I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago now already, he started complaining about the bodybuilders today, saying that they had a U-shape, they didn't have a V-shape. He also mentioned the posing. So now, here we are a few years later, and I wonder if we're starting to see some changes in the sport because of what Arnold said, because now they did reward Sean Roden the title, and he had a much better midsection, much more of a V-shape, and then Brandon Curry wins. And he also instituted a Best Poser Award. And I think this year he started calling it the Ed Corney Best Poser Award in memory of Ed Corney, who passed away on the 1st, January 1st. So I wonder if Arnold's comments have made a difference now in the sport. Do you think so?
Well, I know at the time, it was 2015, because
it
was the Sunday seminar the morning after he made these. And
that was 4 years ago.
He was pretty critical, and he brought Jim Manning's name up, and
which
seemed a bit of a shot. And at the time, I mean, they made it up, but I don't think they would have said, okay, you know, let's change everything. If it did change, it took 3 years for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And Kai
said, I don't know if that resulted in any change. I think I think Roden won because people just felt he was a little better than Phil because of the stomach issue. And I think Brandon they liked his overall look a little better than Bonax, and that could have gone either way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the posing or anything that did, you know, or the.
It seemed like the audience there really approved. You know, there a lot of people were applauding. And then it was spread all over social media. So it almost seems like the fans were in total agreement with what Arnold said. But maybe the judging is behind that a little bit. Like they weren't following the V taper, and they weren't really rewarding the posing.
The fans really feel that way, John. Do they really feel that way? Because the Olympia, you know, those people that go to the Olympia had no problem for the most part with Ronnie Coleman winning a lot of times. And his stomach was becoming enlarged every year, and you know, I used to interview a lot of people from all over the world that went to the Olympia, and the general theme was, we're here to see the freaks.
Yeah.
This is like the Twilight Zone, man. We want to see, you know, 2 hours of freaks up there. We don't care about this. Or, I mean, I realize a lot of people do, but I think a lot of people don't. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to see the bigger, faster, stronger, like the Chris Bell movie was mm-hmm. titled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, if you ask me in the cold light today, you know, I'd say, oh, yes, you know, symmetry and, you know, and yeah, I remember Marcus Rule 1 year where he made the top six at the Olympia. I just looked at him and the back of my head was standing up. I thought, look at this guy. He was so hard and massive and mm-hmm. almost had
yeah, people
sideways.
Marcus Rule.
So you do go for that. You know, in boxing, you might be a, you know, follow the noble art and want, but, you know, you see somebody knocked out of the ring and it's, wow, this is what we came to see, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they want to see something out of the ordinary. They're paying a lot of money. Some of these people are traveling from other countries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no disrespect to these bodybuilders that we're talking about that are smaller with the shape. They are great. But in general, the fans, based on my perception and my interviewing tons of people, is they care more about seeing a big, hard, freaky guy than they do a distended midsection.
Yeah.
I asked them about the posing. They don't even care about the posing. They just want to see the freaks up there.
Do you think the fans that go to the Olympia, though, are representative of most bodybuilding fans? I mean, maybe there's a lot of fans out there that don't like that look, and they do want to see more better posing, and they do want to see better symmetry, but they just don't go to the Olympia.
Well, that's the granddaddy. That's the big dance.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, you know, the biggest crowds every year is at the Olympia. So,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I just think that people, it's a niche sport. It's bodybuilding. As time goes on, people get faster, people get bigger, people get stronger. And whatever they do to get there is another story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm certainly not agreeing with it, that stuff. But what I'm saying is from their viewpoint, they don't really care. Like a football fan goes to the Ram game and the great tackle they have. What's the tackle's name? The all-pro guy. Anyway,
look what that's going to be.
Yeah. You know, when he makes a tackle, the fans jump up. Or when Lyle Alzado used to play, and he'd rip the quarterback's head off, you know, 100,000 people would stand up and cheer. They weren't saying, yeah, but that shouldn't count because he's taking these drugs.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't care about that. They just wanted to see this beast rip this guy's helmet, his head off.
Yeah. But Lonnie, then how can you explain guys like, it wasn't only Zane, but you got guys like Serge Nubre, you got guys like Muhammad McAway, Chris Dickerson, Samir. Those guys were able to beat the bigger guys in the 70s and 80s. So was it just the judging standards were different? The judges were different? I mean,
I don't think the guys were that much bigger than those guys compared to when we moved on. You didn't have people 5'9", 5'10", 275.
No, you never had that back then. No.
I think Arnold at his biggest competed at 237.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At 6'2". So there was a difference in size, but not a huge difference.
Okay.
You know, and plus as time goes on, things progress and people's mind, you change their opinions. And, you know, I remember one, Ted Williamson, who was the district chairman in Southern California mm-hmm. at that time. He's now puts on shows of Spectrum Sports in Northern California. I remember at the 94 Cal at the check-ins, I was at the table, I was emceeing the show. Somebody brought up the Olympia, and I remember him saying, Jesus, that Dorian Yates, I've never seen anybody look like that in my life.
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible? This guy is so freaky in his calves and his back. And, you know, he went on for 5 minutes.
Right, right.
And Dorian wasn't 5'8", 210. You know, so in Ted's opinion, this guy, he had never seen anything like him in all his years of bodybuilding. And he's been around the sport for a long time,
mm-hmm.
for decades, you know. So I just think it depends on the opinion of the judges. And I think a lot of judges are former competitors. Mm-hmm. And they like seeing those big guys like that. I think the mm-hmm. belly thing came, you know, Arnold brought it may have had an effect. Maybe it changed some people's opinions in future contests. But mm-hmm. Phil Heath won the Olympia the year before with a belly. Mm-hmm. And that was after Arnold's complaint about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what you're saying basically is that once the physiques got to a certain, a new level where they got so big, they were never that size before. We can't really go back now because now it's just a
whole different dimension. Think, unless I'm wrong, and Peter may correct me, I don't think we had somebody 100, 150 pounds bigger than the next guy.
Yeah.
You know, remember when Nasser was like 290 at times, mm-hmm. 280 on stage, and Dorian was around 260, if not a little heavier.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got 50 or 60 pounds on somebody. Now, maybe they did have 50 or 60 pounds on Zane or McAway and those people. So, you know, it's, I don't know. You look at Samir Banut in 1983 and you see him by himself and you think, this could be the best physique of all time.
Yeah.
That was an unbelievably, and he was heavier than he was.
He was under 200 pounds.
I think he was only
right.
About 100, how much did you say?
He was under 200. I think he was like 193.
Yeah, he told me he was 185.
Yeah.
He told me he was 185 at World Gym one day, and he's about 5'7". So, you know, I think it cuts both ways. I think you got the smaller, more symmetrical, great posers, beautiful to watch, a champion. You got somebody bigger, harder, not quite as symmetrical. Maybe the posing's not as good. That's a champion, too. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on a matter of opinion of what you think is, you know, like I said, it's not the 100-meter dash. It's not MMA where one person knocks the other person out. You know, this is
right.
Everybody's got different viewpoints of what they think is the champion.
Yeah.
There's one other name. I'm just going to go back a bit in the 90s. Who I could, and it's not British bias. I could never figure out why Ian Harrison didn't do better. I mean, you talk about an X-frame and a tight waist and broad shot, the sweep, the taper, the full thighs.
Right.
He did. He quit at 27. Not you know, umbrage, but just what is the point of this? You know, he's got a family, or he's just been married, he's got a family. And in a way, it you know, he talks today. He's just sold his gym. He lives out here 2 hours away from all he's got. He lives in a 4-acre spread. He went into wrestling, and then he owned his gym. And he says, it was the best move I ever did. If I'd have kept battling along and taking these guys on, I'd have had to up what I was taking, run the risk of the stomach. And he says, I might be having health problems today, but I was only a pro for 4 years. You know, mm-hmm. So I don't carry that sort of baggage. But that you know, you see some shots of him. I mean, those Chris Lund shot in Central Park with him leaning on a rock, and he's like, what is wrong with that physique?
I know the shots you're talking about. Yeah.
Well, he wasn't from the United States. I think the U.S. bodybuilders definitely had an edge, maybe subconsciously, but most of the judging panel, I think, was U.S.-based, which certainly could have played a role.
Well, I just wonder because, I mean, Peter just said earlier in our interview, he said, classic physique is what bodybuilding really is. I mean, that is what bodybuilding is. It's supposed to be about symmetry and proportion. But, you know, and I hear people say, well, that's what a bodybuilder should look like Samir looked, like Zane looked, like McAway looked. But those guys can't compete today in the open class. So is it just because once the physiques reached a certain standard because of the drugs or whatever it was, and, you know, in the 90s, and they got so big that now we can't go back to that? We can't reward a smaller guy over a bigger guy. Because the standards have been raised now, you know, it's a whole new ball game. So is that what it is? Is it just the judging standards are different, or we're just used to this new kind of physique?
Well, I think it goes back a little bit to what I'm saying. We've got a clutch of guys in now that they have to move on, and we have to get a new set of guys in who have been training since the age of 18, 19, 20, mm-hmm. turn pro with a classic physique. But if they see these guys still being marked up, they want to win. If a rule came out that you'd have to have one calf 3 inches bigger than the other, they'd all have one calf 3 inches.
Then Dennis Wolf would win.
Yeah. whatever.
Dennis Wolf would dominate.
Yeah. They have to look at what's winning and say, right, that's what I have to go with. And we had this conversation once before, John, about the 1990 drug test at Olympia.
Yeah.
Guys went into that show who were far from the best. And it drew two levels of bodybuilder. You know, there was guys that Mike Christian came in, he went through that circumventing thing, whatever it was called, you know, to pass the drug test. Very few of the guys looked the best. And, of course, the WBF came in and that screwed it up completely. But they were going to go ahead with drug testing. Now, I think with drug testing, I'm not saying they should do it. What you'd have to do is say, we're going to start drug testing in 3 years. So guys can get ready for it, siphon off what they have to do. Other guys can say, you know what, my career is 3 years old. I'm going to load up and win some shows. But I think the sport would go backwards with if that 1990 lineup had been the lineup for the next few years with Lee Haney, you know, 10 pounds lighter, and even Sean, he, you know, he'd
sort he was
of,
190.
Yeah, you know, as I remember it, you know, the only ones that were in the relatively good shape towards the best was Mike Christian, Frank Hillebrand, surprisingly, Francis Benfetto, and even Labrada was.
Lee Labrada, I thought, looked pretty good.
Yeah, but.
But, you know, as I was walking out of the venue, I heard a bunch of fans saying, because five or six of the guys flunked the test, they weren't even in the show. And I heard a bunch of people saying, I'm never coming back to this show. They're doing this testing, and look how small they look. And this isn't what I came to see. A lot of people were upset.
You're right. I mean, at the press conference, which was open to the public, everybody was getting up and saying, hallelujah, drug-free bodybuilding. Here we come, you know, blah, blah, blah. And this is a great day for bodybuilding. Of course, then five guys failed. Benaziza, DeMay,
J.J. Marsh.
Vince Comerford and
Mike Van Quinn, Lowe. I think.
No, he was in it, but he didn't look.
Yeah, Quinn was in it. Yeah.
Oh, Mike Quinn. Oh, he passed the test.
Yeah, he got 11.
Yeah, but when you know that hallelujah, I want to testify feeling from the press conference. When the lineup came out, everybody went, "Oh, what did you say? We didn't pay to see this. We didn't see to see." You know, these guys not at the best. And we're not even seeing six or five of the other guys. We never saw Benaziza, who was hot as hell at that time, and Barry DeMay. You know, we never saw them. So they fell down. And, of course, the WBF, that they couldn't allow.
I think it's hard to go backwards.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know what going backwards really means, I guess. But it's just hard when you reach a certain level. And I hate to use the analogy with track and field because it's really not the same thing. But we don't want to see guys running 10 flat.
Yeah, right.
We want to see them run 9.5.
Well, that's it. That's when all the Ben Johnson thing came out, you know. And
right.
You're right.
88 Olympia.
I mean, when they had those Dublin inquiries in Canada and interviewed him and everybody else, the Canadian public changed their mind. They said, well, he's only doing what everybody else is doing. You know, it's not like he's cheating in the sense that he's doing something nobody else is doing.
And then when he came back after the suspension, he ran 10.3, and no one even knew who he was anymore. They didn't even go to see him.
Right.
But, you know, and there's all this hypocrisy, isn't there? The Olympics, you know, we want a clean Olympics. They want to see world records broken, just as Coca-Cola do and NBC who run it. If no world records move forward for 20 years, nobody would be watching it anymore.
Right, right.
Well, here's a question I have for you, John, and I understand your viewpoint. If you like the more, you know, the symmetrical, tighter physique compared to the monsters, but let's take Dorian Yates, 1993, and Peter said 95 was his best. So either way, 93 or 95, how do you go from that? And then you have a Frank Zane type win the Olympia.
Right.
After that. How could that possibly be done? That's such an extreme difference. You know, and through the years, bodybuilders, for whatever it took, I don't know what it took or what it didn't and how much was genetics and how much wasn't. But again, the bigger, stronger, faster, that's its progression.
Yeah. Well, what
and
if
once
we took
you reach that level?
What if we took Arnold from 74 and compared him to Phil Heath from 2017 or 2018?
Today's standards, Phil Heath would win.
Of course, the other side of the coin, I know what you're saying there, John, but just think if Arnold had access to what these guys have, you know.
You're saying what Arnold looked like in 74, 75.
Yeah, I think that's what John meant. Yeah, and Phil would win that, you know. more complete, more detailed, thicker. You know, he'd be as heavy as Arnold, you know.
But you see it all the time on social media where they'll take a picture of Arnold from 75 and a picture of Ronnie, and everybody goes for Arnold because he's got the smaller waist and he's got better, you know, symmetry and proportions, even though Ronnie was much, much bigger. You're looking at one pose too, you know.
We ran a contest in Flex once saying, of all the bodybuilders of all the years, going back to Grimmick, who would you most like to look like? And I think it was something like 45% said Frank Zane.
Yeah.
That was, you know, that was like the acceptable face of bodybuilding for the individuals, the readers. Now, whether that would translate into them saying, yeah, let's have a Frank Zane type winning the Olympia at under 200 pounds and accepting it.
That well, you know, speaking of polls, Bruce Willis won the best body. The People magazine did one of those things, who has the best body in the world of entertainment. And Bruce Willis was first, and Brad Pitt won it another year, and Arnold was like 20th. So the general population likes that leaner look and more, you know, everyday fit model look. But does the bodybuilding fan who's going to the Mr. Olympia paying $500-$700 for a ticket, does he want to see that?
No.
I don't think that's been answered.
Well, I think once a certain level of conditioning is reached or a new level of development, we can't go backwards. Like once Gaspari had the glutes, everybody had to have the glutes. And now you talked about
exactly. I was just going to bring that up. That's exactly that killed Wheeler and Troy Alves, like Peter said.
Yeah,
and it's hard to go in reverse when you're on the freeway.
Yeah. And you got the gut sticking out now, but you have the ripped glutes and hamstrings. And we were talking about Phil Heath from last year from the back. He was incredible, and a lot of that is his back and his glutes and his hamstrings. So Arnold didn't have that. Zane didn't have that because that wasn't required back then. So it's like you can't go backwards, you know, once you have that level.
Yeah, that's why I got out of it, because I had the belly and no glutes. I was deficient in all areas. But I said it's very symmetrical. Every body part sucks equally.
Right. Yeah. I've been called one of the most outstanding asses in bodybuilding.
I know you got to go pretty soon, but right before we go, I want to ask, now this Classic Physique, they started it a few years ago now, and everybody thought this was going to be the new big thing. It seems like it really hasn't taken off yet. Do you think it's just because, like Peter, you were mentioning, the magazines are no longer around, so the personalities cannot be developed as much as they were before? Why do you think the Classic really hasn't gone to the next level yet?
Well, it needs somebody to come along who is a real superstar, and somebody that you could look at and say, you know what, this guy could take those guys on. I mean, like I said earlier, I think in some of the shows, it's difficult for the judges, where condition is such a priority in the open, for them to, you know, transition into saying we're looking for a slightly different package this time. The guy's got to be in shape. He's got to be hard. He's got to be separated. But he doesn't have to be ripped to shreds if he's got, you know, a great shape. I mean, Brian Ansley is a worthy champion, but I like the...
He's small. He's small.
Yeah, dramatic looks of Henry Pierre Aino and Steve Laureus and Chris Bumstead when he's in shape. There's others as well that they're coming in the way I think they should be coming in, but they're not getting the recognition because the judges are still... You know, you sit there all day marking conditions, then you've suddenly got to change. You know, it can be a bit difficult. You need somebody to come in who was just absolutely stunning with charisma and takes that Classic division on his own, you know, and lifts it like Arnold did. You know, the NAPA was the biggest contest, much bigger than the Olympia until 72, until Arnold just took over. I know he won in 70, 71, but top guys were still going to NAPA. It wasn't until 72 that the Olympia had better lineups than the NABBA universe. Of course, part of that was the IFBB saying, if you enter the NABBA, you can't enter our contest. So that was part of it. But
so you think you need...
And look at Pumping Iron. You know, you go back to the great movie Pumping Iron, and really what it was about was Arnold Schwarzenegger, there's never been another Arnold. I don't think there ever will be. And big Lou Ferrigno, the 6'5", 275-pound kid from Brooklyn. Two big guys. Arnold was big.
Yeah.
Louis was bigger. I mean, there were other guys involved in it, of course, but I think that the crowds rallied around those two guys.
Yeah.
So you think what classic physique needs is a guy like Arnold, someone with the charisma and the physique who's going to really capture the imagination of the fans.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you can get that. You know?
I don't know. I don't know whether you can or not, but I'm saying that's one way to lift it, you know, to get somebody who's absolutely astonishing, comes from nowhere, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You mentioned Breon, Peter, and I saw him at Gold's Gym North Hollywood about a month ago where he works out most of the time. And I was shocked how little the guy is in person.
Yeah.
You know, I've only seen him on stage. And I think that does, you know, in certain cases, size does matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he was good enough to win 2 years in a row.
Yeah, that's right. But if you put Breon Ansley on stage against Phil Heath, what do you think? I mean, I don't think his great shape's going to have him defeat Phil Heath.
No.
I think Phil Heath just totally overpowers him.
Well, talking about that classic division, do you think if they really brought up the posing and they started posing like some of the guys in 88 at that 88 Olympia did, or like Sean Ray did, do you think it would change the popularity of the sport? Do you think the fans would get more behind it?
My opinion, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is what it is. It's, you know, people like, in my experience in 35 years in the industry, and I don't know how Peter feels, but, you know, they want to see, like I think Peter called it the circus. You want to see the freak. You want to see something different. These other guys have beautiful physiques, no question about it. But are they something different?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as one guy said, walking out of the Olympia in 1990, I can see these physiques at the neighborhood pool. Now, that's an exaggeration, of course, but I understood what he was trying to say.
Right.
So in classic physique, the problem is you can only be so big. You got the limitations of the weight.
Right.
So, I mean, I hope that it can do that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not against it. I think classic physique, I really admire those physiques. Some great bodybuilders.
Mm-hmm.
Well, bodybuilders, classic physique bodybuilders. But with the size, the limitation on weight, can you really get somebody dominating enough that's going to have this tremendous following? I'm not sure.
Well, I think
you know, take away the freaks at the Olympia, keep every other division at the Olympia, but take out the men's bodybuilding. How many people would be in the seats?
Yeah, but I still think that in the Open and the Classic anyway. If you're given 3 minutes on stage to pose, why don't you take full advantage of it and try and get the audience stirred up? It'll make a difference, even with the judges. You know, it's like a boxer. You know, he goes to training camp for 3 months. He goes through hell. He drops 20 pounds to get ready. Then he gets into the ring and puts one hand behind his back. Give them all the tools. It might be a pipe dream. All the guys won't do it. But I'm telling you, you know what happened when somebody like a Marcus Haley or Darren Charles, Melvin Anthony, Freddie Smalls comes out. The place goes nuts because the audience is sitting there waiting to be entertained.
Right.
But look at the Arnold Classic. You never hear a bigger roar throughout the whole weekend than when them strongmen come on. People are standing in the aisles. You don't see them doing that with the bodybuilding, and the bodybuilding is supposed to be the main thrill event of the evening.
Yeah. Well, you don't even see anybody posing like Lee Labrati used to pose or Sean Ray used to pose. I mean, Arnold has that new division now for the best poser, and I watched the guy who won. I think it was Joshua Leonardowitz. Nothing against him, but it wasn't that outstanding. It wasn't that great, you know, for a best poser award.
We've had that before. They had that before at the Arnold, the best poser and the most muscular.
Yeah,
and
I remember
they took
that.
It away. And then they brought it back and they took it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, Peter mentioned Melvin Anthony. He's probably my favorite all-time poser.
Yeah.
But I've had people tell me, what is this guy doing up there dancing? This isn't a strip club. I just want to see posing. This is bodybuilding. Mm-hmm. So even as great as Melvin Anthony was, there were a lot of people that criticized that type of posing, which I love. And I agree with you guys. We need some type of entertainment. Some effort needs to be put in that posing round. Because it is, if it is judged, you got to give it more credence than they do. And if it's not really important, let's don't have it. Like Peter said, we'll be at Morton's at 7 o'clock.
Well, what amazes me is with all the social media out there now, if someone ever did come out and do a kick-ass posing routine, can you imagine how much that would be shared, and it would be all over the place because no one else is doing it.
I'll give you an example of this one, John. I put on a show called the NPC West Coast Classic every June here in Riverside. 2 years ago, we had Oksana do a routine. Oksana Grishina, the great fitness champion, who's just spectacular. And we had three bodybuilders do a skit with her. It was hilarious. I mean, she was phenomenal, but they added some fun to it as well. Dave Lieberman took a cell phone video of that and put it up on social media, and it got, on his cell phone, he got over 100,000 views. For her, the performance that she did and these guys in the background, over 100,000. So obviously somebody loved it because everybody was going to it and watching it.
Yeah,
it's my favorite poser is Durham Charles. The reason is he always does something different. You know, the rest of the guys I mentioned, basically it's, you know, a modification of what we've seen before, but he'll come out, he'll do the breakdancing, he'll do, but when he comes out and does that slow motion walk, you know, it's always something different, something creative.
Same Vince Taylor ranks up there as well, and even Kamali, who wasn't a big fan of mine, I enjoyed his routines.
And Francis Benfatto, I mean, when he was, you were at that Masters, weren't you, Lonnie, in Miami, where he
phenomenal.
I mean, what was he, 50 then or something?
Not only posing, but Michael Nevue thought Francis Benfatto had the best physique in all of bodybuilding. He's looking light in the legs, but, you know, I guess Michael didn't really analyze it other than from a photographer's viewpoint, but he said this guy's the best in the whole sport.
Well, he had this.
He thought he should be winning the show, the Olympia every year.
If you take his physique apart, there is discrepancies with symmetry. You know, he's got that short torso, long legs, but it's the spectacular round muscle bellies and the sweep to his, you know, his taper. That bit like Arnold, you know, not perfect symmetry, but just these lines that just take your breath away. And
comes all together, yeah.
Yeah.
And Arnold had something, then Francis had it too. But Arnold has had that something, that it factor that John mentioned about Rory. Just when he walked on stage, there was something special. Before he even went into the posing. You know, certain people just light up a room when they walk in. And Arnold did that. And I think Benfatto did that. We've had others that have done that, but not to the degree of Arnold. You know, we've been waiting for 50 years for the next Arnold. We've had some people that look like him, talk like him, walk like him, but they haven't been the next Arnold, you know, and that's not an easy task to complete.
You mentioned before the it factor. I asked him once, everybody says you've got the it factor. What is the it factor? He says, I don't know, and I don't want to know. I'll just accept it as it is. I don't want to, you know, analyze it to death and then lose it, you know.
Well,
and he mentioned other people that have the it factor. You know, he says Bill Clinton's the same when he, despite everything. He said he walks into a room and everybody gravitates towards him. You know, there's a
right.
Yeah,
and that's, I don't know if we've had anybody in bodybuilding in recent years, it really approaches that type of charisma.
Oh, no.
You know,
I mean, he had it all together. I mean, he's we'll never see another one like him. I mean, things happen for him. Pumping Iron, if it hadn't been for him, they'd have probably stopped filming after 15 minutes. You know, there's nothing going on.
Yeah.
There, you know?
Yeah.
He did it with his big chance to make a mainstream impact, you know, and he took it with both hands. With it. The other guys, they wanted to sort of have Frank Zane involved a lot more, but so I was told, you know.
Didn't have the personality.
Yeah, he
was concentrated on getting ready for the contest.
Yeah,
Frank's a quiet guy and all that, and Arnold just, like you say, he lights up the room when he walks in. And I said a long time ago, I don't think there'll ever be an Arnold in the world of bodybuilding. And so far I'm right, but, you know, I could be wrong. I just don't see it. Do you guys see anybody on the horizon that could approach that level?
No, I don't. No.
No, we haven't seen him yet. You know, if there is one, you know, if the physiques keep going the way they are, even if this guy comes along, he might be big in bodybuilding. But there was something acceptable about watching those guys in the gym in 1975 when it was filmed. You know, Arnold was huge, but he had a flat stomach and great lines. And, you know, the other
yeah, but see, huge in those days was, he probably was never more than 240.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said he competed at 237. That, he told me that was his heaviest. I don't know if he still feels that way, but at almost 6'2".
Well, he told you 250, right, Peter, in 71?
Yeah, he told, I always thought his best was 74, and I asked him, he says, no, in 71, where he didn't really compete again, it was in Paris, and he spent a lot of time in Munich, Germany.
Yeah.
He said it was 250, and he says he thinks that's the best. But because the show didn't get great coverage, the physique didn't get as much coverage.
Yeah.
But he did, you know, he did repeat it because I thought, I was more talking about the year. You know, I thought 74 was his best. For 75, he'd come back from making Stay Hungry, and he was nowhere near the weight he had been in previous years. I think he was, you know, like you say, too.
But even today at 6'2", if somebody's around 250, they can go, hey, he's too small.
Yeah.
You know, the lat 6'1.5", 285 or whatever he was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
That's even another example of things, you know, has it gotten out of hand? Probably. Mm-hmm. But is that what people wanted to see? You know, well, I think so, based on what I see at the Olympia.
But I think that audience is getting smaller, you know, and
it actually has. You're right. It has gotten smaller.
And you know, the level of pro qualifiers, there's loads of them, but we used to know every pro bodybuilder on the planet, men's open. Now, you know, there was only maybe 50 or 60 at any one time. Now there's thousands of them. You can't keep track of them, who they are, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these other, and all these other divisions.
Yeah.
The men's physique, the classic physique.
The shows are rushed. Those that get all the classes on, you know, it's, I don't know, it's called progress.
When I posted that video of Rory posing, and I said, you don't see this kind of audience reaction to a posing routine anymore. And Jerry Scalise, you remember him, he was a great amateur bodybuilder. He made a comment on my Facebook page, and he said, well, back then they would let these guys go out there for a couple minutes and pose. You don't see that anymore. And I made a comment. I said, I competed a couple of years ago. I came back in 2016, and I was disappointed with how anticlimactic it was, because you only get like 60 seconds of pose. They're rushing everything now because they have so many divisions. I was fantasizing that it was going to be like the 80s and 90s where you get up there and you get the big crowd reaction and you do a great posing routine. And it's not like that anymore.
John, I don't know if you've seen any shows out here locally. My numbers in bodybuilding at the West Coast Classic have remained pretty high for some reason. But the other local shows with all these other divisions like you're talking about, the number of bodybuilders, the numbers have dropped dramatically.
Yep, yeah.
And I think because it's easier. That's why people went from fitness to figure to bikini. Mm-hmm. It was easier. No gymnastics, no dance classes.
Mm-hmm.
Classic physique, I'm not saying it's easy by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's easier than competing in the open because you have a weight limit. You can only get so big.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to go for it, you know, and just wherever you land. That is a problem. You know, everything expands. As we move on, everything expands. I mean, we're probably going to have another division or two in the next 3 or 4 years. It wouldn't shock me. I don't know what it would be.
What the future of bodybuilding is, I wonder, because you don't see the teenagers anymore. You know, so if you look back at the 80s, you had all these teenagers coming up, and that was the future of bodybuilding. Where are the teenagers now? They're all gone. You know, there's like one or two teenagers.
I got rid of teenage bodybuilding in my show because I wasn't getting anybody.
There you go. Yeah.
But back in England in the 80s, you know, the juniors, you know, at regional shows, and regions are a lot smaller. It wasn't like Texas or anything, you know. You get 16 or 20 juniors in the lineup. You know, that was part of the, you know, it was a big turnout. Juniors, you know, in England, that meant being under, once you were 21, you weren't a junior anymore. So these were 18, 17, 19-year-olds, you know, a lot of them went on to, you know.
Yeah, Clark Sanchez told me he used to get 90 or 100 teens at his shows in New Mexico.
That's how it used to be in Chicago, too.
Yeah, so that's...
That's inconceivable.
I remember the teen division being one of the most anticipated divisions in the whole show when I would go watch a contest.
Right.
Say, boy, the stars of tomorrow on stage tonight. Let's see what we got here. And there'd be really a lot of good teenagers.
Yeah. Well, there's some people in the industry that are predicting that classic is going to take over and open bodybuilding is going to fade as the years go on. And if we don't have new guys coming into open bodybuilding, you know, that might happen. Because like you said, Lonnie, your numbers are going down, right, in open bodybuilding.
Numbers are going, yeah. And I'm just wondering, I hope that it's true that if the classic takes over, you can still get the huge crowds. I'm just not so sure you're going to get as big a following as you had with the freaks.
Right. Hmm. Right.
Right or wrong, you know, and that's all individual opinion. But I just think if it's a knit, you know, I'm not going to an opera if you give me two free tickets. I'm not going, mm-hmm. you know, and I think the people and most of the ticket buyers at my show, and I think most amateur shows are there because their friends or family is in the contest.
Yeah.
They're not going just to watch the show.
When I posted that Rory video, somebody said, well, the reason why he got such big reaction was a lot of that audience was bodybuilding fans. It wasn't just other competitors. And they said, that's what you get.
From our gym.
Yeah.
From our gym. About 100 people went up there from the Astro gym.
Okay.
So that helped.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, you know, what a great physique that guy had. And he still does has a great physique.
Yeah.
He's 63.
Yeah.
He still looks great.
Yeah, he does. He does for sure.
He had that it factor, I thought, but he just didn't quite make it. Well, 83 Nationals, he loses to Bob Paris by a point. The same rules then that we have today. Rory would have been a pro in 83.
Right, right, because it's a top two.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Anyway. Well, yeah, I know you got to go, Lonnie. Well, thanks, Lonnie, for coming on the show for the very first time. It was great having you.
Well, thanks for having me. It was an honor being on with Peter McGuff.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for coming on again. I appreciate both of you guys coming on. I definitely appreciate your opinions, and you guys are really experts in the sport. So it's been great having you on, talking about the shape of bodybuilding and where it's going, and hopefully we can have you guys on again.
Yeah, one time maybe. I don't want to push this, but maybe sometime in the future you can have me and Lonnie on again, and we can talk about the gossip wars back in the 80s. And
yeah, that'd be great.
Oh, boy,
me and Laurie were rivals. We weren't, you know. We.
I could write a book on the troubles that I've had.
Yeah.
That sounds like a great discussion in the future for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll end with this one line. You know, Dorian really was upset, like I said before, that I didn't pick him to win that Olympia and my bogus Olympia prediction. So in 95, he was guest posing. I think it was the Nationals. Was it the Nationals, Peter, in Louisiana?
Yeah.
And he brought it up again. He said, you know, well, you didn't pick me. You said all these great things about me, but you didn't pick me. And I said, well, I was just trying to be entertaining. And then in the next issue of Flex, Peter wrote about it. He goes, well, why don't you just try to be right? That was funny.
Oh,
I loved
great.
His wit, you know, even though I was the brunt of that one, you know, I was laughing.
Oh, yeah, Peter's got the lines for sure.
Yeah, you can't beat that British wit, I tell you.
Right.
You know, I'm really from Oklahoma, and I put this accent on. Get right. Yeah. Everywhere.
Well, you were great in those Naked Gun movies.
If I had a dollar every time somebody had said that.
You know, when did you change your name from Leslie Nielsen? I don't understand this.
Yeah.
He's just jealous of your silver hair, Peter.
I'm jealous of anybody's hair. Especially yours, John.
Yeah, mine's still hanging in there, too.
Can you start thinning a little bit at least?
I remember one time I was with you, Lonnie, somewhere, and I think Dave Lieberman was getting in the car, and you said, your hair's going in the same direction as somebody's fastball or something, because his hair was receding.
Oh, his hairline, yeah.
Right, right, right.
Well, I'm an expert in hair loss, so all you got to do is look at me, you know. And
hey, well, it's been great.
Yeah, it's been great having you guys
enjoyed
on
this, and
we'll bring you on again.
We'll do it again sometime. Like Peter said, let's talk about the other side of the game.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good.
The gossip news side and troubles that we had and what we wrote and what we said and
right.
I can
right.
tell you all kinds of good stuff, how many times I was threatened.
Right. Those gossip columns had a lot of weight back then.
Oh, way more than I even imagined.
Yeah.
especially in those picks when I did the picks for the Olympian. I tried to pick somebody different every year, just to be stupid and funny and entertaining. They didn't think it was stupid and funny and well, they thought it was stupid. They didn't think it was entertaining. The athlete.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna say, I'll tell you about the time I was surrounded by about six of them at the USA in Vegas. I thought it was over for me. I couldn't believe it. You know, my stupid pick. What did that mean? That meant nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And Flex Wheeler would say, well, you know, you got all this power and your pick does mean something. I said, well, how come I'm never right then?
The power of the pen, right?
So I started going with the winners, and I became smart again, you know, by going with the defending champions.
Swami.
Yeah, the Swami.
All right, guys. Well, Thanks again for joining me, and I appreciate it having both
John,
you guys on.
John, you take care. Peter, you be well, and we'll talk soon.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lenny. Bye-bye. Thanks, Peter. Bye. Take care.
All right. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank again our guests, Peter McGuff and Lonnie Tieper, who was his first time on the show. Thank you for coming on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I really enjoyed that interview with you guys, and thanks also to Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And now, before you go, I want to read an article from the October 14th issue, 1974 issue of Sports Illustrated. It's called The Men and the Myth, and it's written by a writer named Richard W. Johnston. And it is, as far as I know, the first article that was written about bodybuilding. And this takes place in 1974, right before the 1974 Mr. Olympia. So here we go. For years, bodybuilding has been the victim of calumny and sniggering rumor, an embarrassment to its practitioners and few devotees. But today's master builder, Arnold Schwarzenegger, is pumping up enthusiasm for his sport. About three blocks southwest of respectability in downtown Los Angeles, a little bar called Lang's is lodged like a formica pebble in one corner of the old Embassy Hotel. One evening last August, some of its patrons were discussing the long line of people ranging up Grand Avenue from the entrance doors of the Embassy Auditorium. "What's going on out there?" the bartender asked a middle-aged woman, whose angularity was emphasized by heavy horn-rimmed glasses. "I'll tell you what's going on out there," the woman replied. "It's those muscle men. You know, the men with the biggest muscles in the world. I wouldn't go see them for nothing. Not for nothing." As Lawrence Welk beamed down from the bar TV, the woman's escort favored her with an appreciative smile. "I'd kind of like to see him," he said, in a voice inviting further denunciation. "Forget it, honey," the lady said, clutching an arm that emerged like a bent chopstick from her friend's sport shirt. "Oh, are those guys going to hurt in 20 years? You just wait until they get old and their muscles get flabby. Oh, are they going to ache all over?" Lang's is a bar for regulars, for the disinherited, financially or physically. It is a comfortable Archie Bunker-type bar, where prejudice are welcome but not dissent. "Wonderful, wonderful," a salmon-pink Lawrence Welk intoned. Outside in the deepening twilight, the crowd had begun to move into the auditorium, passing between posters proclaiming the greatest muscle show ever. Ranged below the black-and-white headline were silhouetted photos of six extravagantly distended figures. Arnold Schwarzenegger, 5 times Mr. Universe, 4 times Mr. Olympia. Franco Colombo, Mr. Universe, Mr. World. Frank Zane, Mr. America, Mr. Universe. Lou Ferrigno, Mr. America, Mr. Universe. Serge Nubre, Europe's greatest bodybuilding star. And Ken Waller, Mr. America, Mr. World. By the time the greatest muscle show ever began, there was no standing room left in the 2,100-seat auditorium. 200 people were turned away. In most ways, this was an unexceptionable crowd, courteous and responsive, but also discriminating and critical. The racial mix was about what one would expect in a city as variegated as Los Angeles, and the income levels, as expressed by dress, seemed just as various. There were girls who obviously hoped to be mistaken for starlets, and men in well-tailored suits. There were lots of sports shirts, it was a sultry night, and hundreds of pantsuits. There were a few apparent homosexuals and a scattering of female groupies. Almost without exception, this was a crowd whose members knew how to look at what they were about to see. There was only one distinguishing thing about this group. It was the largest ever to see a bodybuilding contest in Los Angeles. Though it numbered only 2,300 people from a metropolitan area of 7 million, the Little League in Inglewood draws more. This weekend in Madison Square Garden in New York, another small crowd, perhaps too small to even fill the 4,500-seat Felt Forum, will gather to see the superstar of the Embassy show, Arnold Schwarzenegger, defend for the fifth time a world championship, Mr. Olympia, that 99% of Americans have never even heard of. Just to be in the new garden and not the soiled old Embassy in Los Angeles or the Brooklyn Academy of Music is a leap forward for a sport that has languished for half a century in the subcellar of U.S. esteem. Those who do attend will see the exemplar of bodybuilding at the absolute peak of his powers. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the 27-year-old Austrian Oak, may be the most extraordinary athlete anywhere today, as well as the most perfectly developed male in history. Yet, on past form, it seems unlikely that local newspapers will even mention the event, although there's always the possibility that one of them will send a feature writer to deride, quote, the male beauty contest, unquote. For the voice of Lang's Bar is the voice of America, and not just blue-collar America. Americans unite routinely to denounce bodybuilders as narcissists, exhibitionists, degenerates, freaks. Although, like the lady in the bar, most have never seen one, and never will, not for nothing. The bodybuilder is at once said to be muscle-bound and the possessor of fictional muscles ballooned by drugs. He is both a cretin and a cunning egomaniac with evil intentions. Name your evil. To the considerable reassurance of the golfers and bowlers and round-the-clock TV football fans in their lives, women usually can be counted on to indict bodybuilders as grotesque. These demeaning stereotypes seem all the more curious in a society that in the last 20 years has elevated physical fitness to the level of a national concern. Bodybuilding is simply one of the three branches of intense weight training, and there is no orchestrated denigration of the other two, Olympic and power weightlifting. The followers of all three disciplines pump iron in the same gymnasiums and follow strict nutrition programs. Many other sports have for years relied on weight training to condition or rehabilitate participants. Such exercises are indeed highly approved if their purpose is to return a man to the kind of action in which he may again be ripped apart. Some of the derision can be traced to the Olympic and powerlifters themselves, whose specialties place no emphasis on symmetry of the body. Their distaste for bodybuilders dates from the 20s, but it was given the force of gospel after World War II by Alistair Murray, national coach of the British weightlifting team, who denounced bodybuilding as muscular development without purpose. The Olympic lifter consoles himself with the notion that bodybuilders lack the speed and thick-waisted stability required by the two Olympic events, the snatch and the clean and jerk. The powerlifter, whose only goal is sheer strength, frequently cultivates a barrel belly, one he can bounce against his knees as he hoists 700 or 800 pounds from the floor in the deadlift. To him, a 37-inch waist under a 57-inch chest is a sign of weakness, and he pretends to have no respect for a man like Schwarzenegger, who has labored 12 years to achieve those precise dimensions. To thus sculpture his body, Schwarzenegger has pumped more iron than most power men could lift in two lifetimes. But so what? As one paunchy powerlifter said recently, "What the hell do they do with all those muscles? I'll tell you what they do. They get up on a little velvet platform and pose. That's right, pose. La-di-da." Certainly one of bodybuilding's liabilities in the public's mind is the fact that its achievements are demonstrated on the posing platform. The very word pose is a semantic disaster derived as it is from the French poseur, suggesting phoniness and nothing more strenuous than the languid lift of a monocle. It hardly describes the bodybuilder's act, which is about as la-di-da as a 100-yard kickoff return. In a maximum of 2 minutes, moving gracefully but dynamically from one position to another, a bodybuilder must demonstrate that he has developed and defined every imaginable muscle to its logical extreme for his height and skeletal structure, and has established a connection between each that creates an impression of perfect symmetry. As Schwarzenegger and a few other virtuosos perform it, posing is an athletic and artistic display that communicates as much emotion as a Bobby Thompson home run or a Joe Namath bomb thrown 60 arching yards 10 seconds before the final gun. The ideal, if less familiar analogy, is the fauna of the great matador as he moves a perfect bull through a series of linked natural passes. The olays crack the sky at such moments, and the embassy crowd's reaction to Arnold on the stand moved from ovation to ovation, a phenomenon almost certain to be repeated at the forum. In the superb new book Pumping Iron, to be published next month by Simon & Schuster, novelist Charles Gaines, the first writer to explicate the mystique of bodybuilding and firmly validate it as a legitimate sport, quotes Steve Mihalik, who was the AAU's Mr. America of 1972. Quote, "When I'm up on that stage, I'm there by myself, me alone. I'm not up there with a baseball bat. I'm not up there with a football. I'm there with just me, my body," unquote. It is this performance without props that seems the most difficult concept for the American public to grasp. It is, of course, a subjective performance. The poser is using his own body as a field in the same way that the figure skater uses ice or the diver air and water. And he will be judged in the same way, on form, grace, and skill. The totero can always blame the bull if he fails. The bodybuilder can only blame himself. The image that affects bodybuilding in the U.S. has not been fashioned entirely by uncomprehending or envious weightlifters, nor does it derive exclusively from the sport's unfortunate nonclementure. There is something more in the mix, and it is not very hard to identify. It dates from a 1920s idea that the male body, while perhaps the temple of the soul, deserved little respect and no glorification. The public attitude was set by the infant Time magazine, which hung a derisive tag on that early and much maligned physical culturist, Bernard McFadden. Bernard Body Love McFadden, Time said, and said, and said, and said. It was not until the 1930s that exercise in general began to gain a little respectability, and in 1939, the AAU staged its first Mr. America contest, being careful, of course, not to identify bodybuilding as a sport, a position that remains unchanged today. But it took the World War II draft and the physical deficiencies among the male population that it revealed to jolt Americans into the notion that exercise was really important. In the late 1940s, two brothers from Montreal, Ben and Joe Weider, challenged Bob Hoffman, whose York, Pennsylvania barbell company was virtually a monopoly and who financed and thus dominated the AAU weightlifting committee. The Weiders founded the International Federation of Bodybuilders. While Ben Weider was cajoling barons and dukes and prime ministers and rajahs into joining the new group, 87 countries now are members, and the General Assembly of International Sports Federations has recognized the IFBB as the official world governing body. Brother Joe moved to the U.S. and engaged in an all-out war with Hoffman. Although Joe Weider bills himself as the trainer of champions and the discoverer of the Weider principles of weight training, his motives were by no means altruistic. En route to becoming millionaires, both Weider and Hoffman expanded their product lines to include hundreds of diet supplements, special exercisers, tanning oils, and magic lotions. Hoffman has never considered AAU bodybuilders as much more than an attractive nuisance. Attractive because they can be used to swell the gate at weightlifting contests, but he has no intention of relinquishing them to the Weider brothers. The Hoffman-Weider War, now a three-cornered affair with the rise of Dan Laurie of Brooklyn as a publisher and contest sponsor, has helped bodybuilding in some ways, but has hurt it in others. The partisans scream at each other in their respective muscle magazines, calling builders affiliated with other entrepreneurs cowards and tricksters, and generally producing an abysmal level of trade journalism. Although anyone leafing through these magazines is likely to find support for his worst suspicion of bodybuilding and bodybuilders. On an early September Sunday, Arnold Schwarzenegger, resting on the seventh day from a grueling week in which he had lifted, pushed, or pulled 240 tons of iron, drove down from his pleasant Santa Monica, California apartment to have brunch at a Marina del Rey waterside restaurant. He brought along his steady, girl-next-door type friend, Barbara Outland, a tanned, honey-haired 26-year-old who teaches English and reading at Lincoln High School in a depressed area of Los Angeles. It was hard to believe that this was the same Schwarzenegger whose marvelously flexed and defined muscles had lifted the embassy crowd to roaring enthusiasm. Off the platform, his muscles relax and fall together. Only the wide shoulders and the expanse of biceps revealed by a short-sleeved sports shirt suggest Arnold's trade. A stranger might easily mistake him for an extremely fit football player. The thing Schwarzenegger cannot control, on stage or off, is that mysterious emanation Hollywood long ago labeled star quality. He seems to light up the posing platform, and at 10 a.m., fully dressed and anonymous, he lights up the restaurant. It is not just the bright blue eyes or the quick smile or the ready wit. Schwarzenegger simply looks delighted to be alive and to be Arnold. One feels that with a single appearance on U.S. television, all channels, he could alter the image of the sport. This morning, he addresses himself to some of the more popular charges, including the claim that bodybuilding is not a sport, that it is development without purpose. Of course, bodybuilding is a competitive sport, he says. What is its purpose? To be the best, as in any other sport. What is the purpose for a sprinter whose goal is to do 100 yards in 9 flat? When you win a contest, you get back satisfaction for all the time you put in training. I also think it's a good sport for everybody, even if one's only desire is to be fit. If you play tennis, you develop your right arm, not much else. But with bodybuilding, you make all your muscles grow. I also like it because it's a lonely sport. You go alone to the gym and figure out your problems alone. You are on your own. That is one thing that impelled me. If I become great, it is because of me, not a coach. If your mind isn't ready for the sacrifice and discipline, no coach can do anything about it. And certainly bodybuilding is an art, as all sports are to a larger or lesser degree. You have to become an artist sooner or later, Schwarzenegger says. If you don't, you build your body wrong. If Michelangelo made a statue with the arms twice as big as the legs, you would have laughed at him. You have to have a really good eye to see, and the good taste to realize that, okay, your arms are too big for your calves. That is why bodybuilders look in the mirrors, not because we are in love with ourselves, like they say, but to check the symmetry, to make sure all this enormous development makes a pleasing whole. So you can see that in bodybuilding, if you don't have an eye, that will be the end of it. Your own eye, however, is not always enough. Joe Reeder is not my coach, Arnold says, but he has a good eye too, and sometimes he can spot changes that I have not noticed and maybe are not good. Also, Joe has found names for many exercises that had none. He calls these the Weider principles, and they help explain bodybuilding to young people. If he wants to call me his pupil, I do not mind. Joe has his own goals, though. I do not agree with many of them. At this point, Barbara Outland interrupts the yoke. Arnold is the most goal-oriented person I've ever met. It takes so much knowledge to do what he has done, an understanding of anatomy, nutrition, your own body, and discipline and self-control. He is very practical. Whatever he does must be useful to him in some way, in the direction of whatever goal he has set. Most single-minded people are pretty grim about their objectives, but Schwarzenegger's saving grace is his perspective and sense of the ridiculous. Bodybuilding is a sport, he says, but it is just a sport. When I first came to this country, I went to see an AAU Mr. America contest. Would you believe it begins with a prayer? The prayer is asking God to help the judges pick the best body. Millions of people are starving in India. Thousands are dying in Vietnam. And these people are asking God to help them. I didn't know whether to fall down laughing or go outside and throw up. Schwarzenegger became involved in athletics as a schoolboy in a country village on the outskirts of Graz, Austria, a city of 225,000, where he was born on July 30, 1947. His father, Gustav, was a big man, a weightlifter, and a redoubtable curler. Until I was 10, I was a rather sickly child, Arnold recalls, but then I suddenly seemed to be well, and I realized I had a strong body. I was very interested in sports, and I decided then and there that someday I would be the best in some sport. His search for the right one to satisfy this resolve qualifies Schwarzenegger as a superb athlete. Perhaps unfairly, bodybuilders who have no experience in other sports are not really considered athletes at all, even by other bodybuilders. I did not then know what would be the sport for me, Schwarzenegger says, so I tried various ones. I began with soccer, skiing, and swimming. When I was 12, I became a wing for the Graz Athletic Club, which was considered the second best team in the city. I did all the usual high school sports, boxing, curling, wrestling, and in track and field, the shot put and the javelin. But when I was 15, members of the soccer team began taking weight training to give us better legs, and I immediately liked that. I had reached my full height of 6'2", and I weighed 160 then. He weighs 240 now. In each sport, I asked myself, can I be the greatest? When I was told my reflexes were not quite fast enough to be a great boxer, I stopped doing that. The same with swimming, where I was also not as fast as the others. When I was 17, I left the soccer team. I love soccer, but in a team sport, you must rely too much on others. I wanted to win or lose on my own. In 1965, when he turned 18, Schwarzenegger volunteered for the Austrian Army, and an intuitive commander gave him several hours off each day to work on Olympic weightlifting, a program Arnold had begun after abandoning soccer. That same year, I won the Austrian Junior Olympic Weightlifting Championships, he recalls, but I had begun to know that it would do more to hurt my body than to build it. I had injuries, as all Olympic lifters do. My elbows, my shoulders, my knees. It's a dangerous sport. The human body is not made to do the Olympic lifts. I had been practicing bodybuilding, too, working on my muscles, not just the Olympic ones, and doing some powerlifting. That year, I went to Stuttgart, and I won the Junior Mr. Europe title. There, Schwarzenegger met a young Sardinian named Francesco Colombo. Colombo was at Stuttgart to compete in powerlifting, and he and Arnold, several years his junior, became best friends, as they still are. A more unlikely-looking combination is hard to imagine. The tall, merry Austrian, who apparently always has approached life with the disciplined mind of a Prussian general and a heart as light as a Strauss waltz, and the short, 5'5", enormously compact Sardinian, black-haired and smoky-eyed, but with lips frequently twitched by a puckish smile. Like Arnold, Franco was a certified athlete. He had ridden in horse races at home, and for a while he held the lightweight boxing championship of Italy. The year I went to Stuttgart, Arnold remembers, I won the Austrian and European curling championships, but I also realized there was no future in curling. I began going to the gym just to do powerlifting and bodybuilding. While he was still in the army, Arnold was offered a job running a gym in Munich, and after his discharge, he moved to the Bavarian capital, where Franco had settled. In 1966, they returned to Stuttgart. Franco won the middleweight powerlifting, and Arnold astonished everyone by winning the heavyweight division. He hoisted 710 pounds in the deadlift, 550 in the squat, and 485 in the bench press, for an aggregate of 1,745 pounds. Even today, the world record is only 2,005 pounds. Schwarzenegger also won the title of Best Built Man in Europe. Later, at Essen, he became Mr. Europe. And so, finally, he had to choose between bodybuilding and powerlifting. It is possible to do both. Franco has done so, and he now claims the world light heavyweight record with an aggregate of 1,865 pounds. The amateur record is 1,680 pounds. He also has won the IFBB Mr. World and Mr. Universe titles, a remarkable achievement in a sport where great little men often lose to good big men. But Schwarzenegger felt he did not have the body structure, short arms, short legs, and a long torso to be the best in powerlifting. In 1966, his only loss in bodybuilding had been in the Mr. Universe competition in London, and in 1967 he went back and he won this highly prestigious event, at 20 the youngest man ever to do so. A year later, he repeated his victory. "That is when I first heard of Joe Weider," Arnold says. "He called and offered to bring me to the U.S. for the IFBB Mr. Universe contest in Florida. So I come and I go to Florida and I get beat by Frank Zane. I was disappointed, but Joe said, 'Come to California and train for 1 year.'" Schwarzenegger had a lot of fun in Munich, training hard, running his gym, chasing girls with Franco, and fighting in beer halls. "Munich is a crazy place," he said. "And the Germans are crazier still. Every day, every single day, I have a fight in Germany. In a bar, somebody hits you before you walk in the door. 20 or 30 people are fighting all the time. Nobody knows who you are or what they're fighting about. They fight until somebody gets knocked down. Then the loser gets up and buys the winner a beer, and everybody's friends. Like that. I was in the newspapers all the time in Munich because of my fighting. I was hardly known as a bodybuilder. Maybe because I never had to buy the first beer. It's still like that. I was there last year at the Oktoberfest, and everybody was still fighting." The year in California was beneficial. In 1969, after he won the IFBB Mr. Universe, Schwarzenegger felt he was ready to confront Sergio Oliva, a truly prodigious bodybuilder who even today has a loyal following that will not concede Schwarzenegger is the better man. In 1969, he wasn't. Oliva, defending his Mr. Olympia title, the Super Bowl of bodybuilding, for the third consecutive year, narrowly defeated Arnold. However, in 1970, Schwarzenegger defeated Oliva twice. once in a Mr. World contest, and then in the Mr. Olympia. Arnold beat him a third time at the Mr. Olympia contest in Paris in 1971, and a fourth time in the 1972 Mr. Olympia contest in Essen. In fact, Schwarzenegger has never lost a contest to anyone since Oliva edged him out in the 1969 Mr. Olympia. If the U.S. really has a boulevard of broken dreams, it is Pacific Avenue in Venice Beach, California. Although Venice Beach fronts on a great golden curve of sand, its canals are green with algae, and its small hotels and ramshackle cottages have gone to seed. Once a haven for retired middle-class Jews who had come to die by its strand, Venice Beach was overrun in the post-war years by successive waves of impoverished adults and then by the flower children celebrated by Lawrence Lipton in his book, The Holy Barbarians. Today, a few old people who have outlived their own expectations hide behind barred windows from the last outpourings of the 60s, used-up rebels, Jesus freaks, strung-out hippies, satanists, ancient winos, and young pushers. It is a strange place to find a shrine dedicated to hard work, self-sacrifice, and physical fitness. But the shrine is there, a square box of a building only two stories high, its front emblazoned with red, white, and blue block letters that say Gold's Gym. Inside, the gym is Spartan. One large two-story room, 40 by 65 feet, walls mirrored, the interior carpeted but cluttered with dozens of strange machines, some with overhead pulleys, some with long bars hinged to the floor at one end, others too complex to describe. Stacked along the walls, under the mirrors, are hundreds of the round iron discs that slide onto bars to make barbells of varying weights. Some weigh only 2.5 pounds, others weigh 45. At 9:30 a.m. on a recent smoggy Wednesday, a dozen or so people are doing various things with various weights. Two of them are among the all-time greats of bodybuilding, Frank Zane and Ken Waller. Zane is an algebra teacher at the local high school. His wife teaches art. While Waller, who was captain of the Western Kentucky football team in 1965-66 and later played in the Canadian Pro League, is an instructor in physical education. His wife is a court reporter. All the great Southern California bodybuilders train here, says Dan Howard, a former University of Tulsa middle linebacker and team trainer with a BA in biology who manages Gold's. Joe Gold started the gym about 8.5 years ago, after Santa Monica closed down the old Muscle Beach. I wasn't around here then, but I guess that was a pretty bad scene, what with the girl groupies and the fags hanging around. All bodybuilders aren't Boy Scouts. Some of them were responding to those crowds in ways that didn't help the sport. Howard meets the obvious question without heat, although all bodybuilders are sick to death of it. I only know of three great bodybuilders in the history of the sport who were homosexuals, he says. There's a higher percentage of that in pro football. Sure, we get some in the gym. We have 250 members, but we don't exclude people because of their lifestyles. On the dot of 10 o'clock, the back door of the gym opens and Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in. There are only casual greetings for the man who has made Gold's internationally famous, but somehow the atmosphere changes. Before he addresses his own Herculean chores, Arnold wanders around the room. Suddenly, every workout becomes brisker and more purposeful. On Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, Schwarzenegger works on his arms, biceps, triceps, and forearms, thighs, quadriceps, calves, gastrocnemius group, and waist, abdominals. On Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, he concentrates on his chest and back, pectorals, trapezius, latissimus, and erector spinae. His shoulders, trapezius and deltoids, and again, his waist and calves. When he is training for a contest, as he is now, Schwarzenegger splits his workouts. 2 hours in the morning, 1 hour in the late afternoon. The weights and repetitions involved stagger the imagination. Some of them include 10 sets of 10 reps each in the bench press, with the barbell load going up to 450 pounds. 100 squats with the load increasing to 500 pounds. 200 curls, 100 with each arm, with dumbbells weighing as much as 100 pounds, and a calf exercise done daily in which Arnold goes up and down on his toes lifting as much as 1,000 pounds of iron, 40 tons a day, 6 days a week. Is all this agony worth the moment of satisfaction that comes at the end of a successful contest? Well, it isn't all agony. There are immediate rewards. First comes the pain, Schwarzenegger says. As the weight gets heavier and the number of repetitions grow, the muscles begin to hurt. Here is where mind and character come in. Here is where you cannot stop if you want to be great. You must be able to tell the muscle to continue until you complete the exercise. You must gut it through. It is the painful part that makes the muscle grow. But then comes the reward. Then comes the pump. As Charles Gaines has written, the pump is the fix and rush of bodybuilding. This is the moment when the bodybuilder stands before the mirror and flexes the muscle and watches a great flow of oxygenated blood spread through it, visibly enlarging it, proving that the previous agonizing minutes have not been wasted. There is more than mental satisfaction in the pump. It has been compared to a feeling of sensual ecstasy or the great well-being that comes to a distance runner 2 or 3 miles into his event. Suddenly something happens that has been a matter of great effort, perhaps even pain, is transformed into a sense of lightness and euphoria, a flush of joy that half convinces him he can run forever. Non-athletes often find it incomprehensible that people who have no chance for greatness will rise at dawn to run 5, 10, even 20 miles, and that they actually seem to look forward to these ordeals. The pump is the answer, and it explains, too, why old bodybuilders never ache away as the lady at Lang's felt they would. They continue their workouts, in modified form, of course, not in desperation, but for pleasure. While most bodybuilders pump up backstage before posing appearances, that is, they do a few quick exercises to start the oxygenation of the blood, Schwarzenegger does not, except during competitions, and then only for insurance. Thanks to his extraordinary concentration and training, Arnold has achieved mental control over his bloodstream. He literally can command his biceps or his abdominals or his quadriceps or whole groups of muscles to engorge. In his bicep flex, for example, the size of the muscle will increase between 10 and 15%. The only parallel to this sort of mental control of the body's normally involuntary systems is provided by Kundalini Yoga, a discipline that takes more years to achieve than Arnold has been alive. If, as Barbara Outland says, Schwarzenegger is the most goal-oriented person she's ever met, what's left for him? Why is he training so hard for this week's Mr. Olympia contest, running 3 miles every other day in deep sand besides doing his 40 tons of weight, when a victory can only reassert what he's already proved? Is being Mr. Olympia 5 times all that much more important than 4? Sipping sangria while eating an omelet at the Brown Bagger in Marina Del Rey after completing a morning workout, Arnold articulates his motivations. When I decide in Germany that in bodybuilding I can become the best, I also think it will last. It is something I can make money at, as well as prove myself. I have made quite a bit of money. Now I want to make more, but I also want to do other things. Schwarzenegger's income now ranges between $40,000 and $60,000 a year, chiefly from endorsements, a mail-order instruction business, and posing exhibitions. Only he and Franco Colombo have been able to support themselves professionally in the sport, although many others have built on it with their own gymnasiums or health clubs. Schwarzenegger had no sooner won his first Mr. Olympia in 1970 than he began to look 5 and 10 years ahead. He had an instinct for business. Instead of swinging giddily with his newfound eminence, he enrolled in the UCLA School of Business Administration. Next spring, he will graduate, not from UCLA, but from Cal State, where he has transferred partly because that is where Barbara is getting her master's. Unlike many business school students, Schwarzenegger did not wait for graduation to get into the marketplace. For years, he started publishing booklets on conditioning and instruction in bodybuilding, both for beginners and advanced students, and this mail-order business has doubled in volume every year since. Defending the Mr. Olympia title is both a matter of pride and a matter of business. The title of Mr. Olympia is valuable, Schwarzenegger says. It means you are the best. Sergio might even enter, although I believe he is under suspension by the IFBB. If he really is serious about wanting a pose down, as he said recently, I will meet him any time if the AAU will sponsor the contest. But Mr. Olympia, even without Sergio, could be a very serious affair because Lou Ferrigno will be there. Being on guard against Ferrigno is good business for Schwarzenegger. The 6'5" Ferrigno won both the AABA Mr. America and Mr. Universe contest last year at the age of 21, and at the embassy he captured the Mr. International title. Bodybuilding contests actually are prejudged in the afternoon, without an audience and under bright lights that make it difficult to conceal any inadequacy. Instant tan lotions and the body oil that make builders glow on the body posing platform at night are barred. The oil can be anything from Bain de Soleil to plain old Wesson. The points of judgment are symmetry, muscle density, and mass, and presentation, posing. The first two must be joined. The mightiest arm cannot overcome a scrawny calf. Only a profound and dramatic reversal of form will change votes at the public show, and even that will not avail if the only improvement is to the posing. None of these things occurred at the embassy. 4 of the 11 judges voted for Ferrigno, the rest splitting their ballots among 4 other contestants. Although Franco Colombo is studying to be a chiropractor, his wife Anita Santangelo is a doctor of chiropractic orthopedics, he joined Schwarzenegger in promoting the embassy show. Like all IFBB contests, the Mr. Olympia accepted, it was an amateur event, which meant that the pros, Arnold, Franco, Zane, Waller, and Noubre, appeared only as guest posers. Either Arnold or Franco could have beaten Ferrigno that night, at least in part because they were better cut up. That is bodybuilding jargon for defined, meaning that all fat or water has been stripped away so that each engorged muscle stands out in stark relief. This stripping is accomplished toward the end of a bodybuilder's training grind by increasing and speeding up repetitions in the gym. The worst thing you can call a competitive bodybuilder is smooth, i.e. undefined. In Los Angeles, Ferrigno looked relatively smooth, and his posing style was unattractive, but he was undeniably massive and had good symmetry. If I had been a judge, I would have voted for him, even though he was not in shape, Arnold says. I would have asked myself, which body up there would I like to have? And I would have said Ferrigno's, because in 30 days I could mold it so that it might beat anybody in the world, including me. Although Schwarzenegger doubts that Ferrigno himself will be able to do that job, he can hardly afford to be wrong. So he's been training like an underdog, pumping extra tons of iron, increasing his protein intake through ordinary foods, and doubling up on vitamins. For the last 6 weeks, he's also taken orally 15 milligrams of Dianabol, an anabolic steroid, each day. Schwarzenegger says that steroids do not build muscle, but they may help sustain it while he's stripping down for a definition. Actually, he says, I think they are virtually worthless, but everybody uses them before contests, so I do too. Again, it's a matter of insurance. Schwarzenegger is genuinely and deeply concerned about bodybuilding's dreary image, particularly as it is projected by the trade press, including Weider's Muscle Builder Power, which has run thousands of pictures of Arnold, and which Arnold has tried to upgrade with occasional byline stories of his own. All of these magazines, Weider's, Hoffman's, Lorry's, I call them comic books, circus books, those headlines, How Arnold Terrorized His Thighs. Ha! This is Joe Weider's biceps speaking. Why are Joe's biceps talking to anybody? It is not that much of a bicep. Joe exposes Lorry, and Lorry exposes Joe, and Hoffman's against everybody and can't tell Joe from Ben or says he can't. Why won't these guys get together? I'll tell you why. It's because none of these silly people are really interested in bodybuilding anymore. They are interested only in the money that can be made from it. Each of them says he is for bodybuilding, but these men are not. They are knocking the sport down. I asked Joe why he prints such junk. Why is everybody bombing and blasting and terrorizing? All these silly words. Joe says it sells the magazines, period. Arnold's ultimate goal is to publish his own magazine about the sport he loves. I would like to get a hold of Joe's magazine, he says, but he will not give up such a sales manual. I will have to start my own magazine, a real magazine, a bodybuilding magazine, not just for something to sell products to 14-year-old boys. It'll just be about the sport. Personal attacks will be out, totally out. If Joe wants to say he built all the champions and trained 3 million bodybuilders, he'll have to do it in an ad, not in an article. The same with Hoffman or Lorry. I have no personal quarrel with any of them. I'll try to get them together so maybe we can have fewer contests, but real champions. Not 3 Mr. Americas, 3 Mr. Worlds, 2 Mr. Universes. Then maybe the sport will have respect, like it has in other countries. In India, 40,000 people turned out to see Bill Pearl. I myself had an audience of 10,000 when I was a guest poser in South Africa. But here? When Franco and I got permission from Ben Weider to promote the Mr. International show at the embassy, I wanted to have it on TV, to sell it to TV. A guy I contacted said yes, they were interested, you know? But first, show us what bodybuilding's all about. All I had to show was Joe's magazine, and they looked at it, and then they were all laughing. They thought the show would be the same thing as the magazine. I'll call you, the guy says. Don't bother, I said. I was embarrassed. Can Arnold Schwarzenegger change bodybuilding's image in the U.S.? Perhaps. Frank Zane says, Arnold is the first person who has ever been in the game who has actively tried to promote it and give it a good name. There may be a clue in Arnold's own name. Schwarzenegger translates literally as black plowman. There is a lot of plowing under, that is, to be done if the next generation of builders is to grow and prosper. All right, so there you go. That was from Sports Illustrated, October 14th, 1974. I love that article. What a classic article. All right, folks, that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. We will see you next week when our guest will be Leon Brown, former IFBB Mr. America, and he was featured in the book Pumping Iron. He's also a good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger, so I'm sure he's going to have some great stories. We'll see you next week. Take care.